Good morning, everybody. Matt Bobala here with you, 720 WGN. We're here until 5 when the morning show takes over with Orion and Max Armstrong. Roger, there is some Papa Nino's pizza down here.
I smelled something all the way up here.
More than welcome to take part in when you get a moment to walk on down.
Will do.
Joining us on the phone right now is our friend Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com. Hey, Chris, how are you this morning?
Hey, Matt, doing well.
Excellent. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate it. I just wanted to check in on what the latest is going on. We checked in with you a month or so ago, I think it was, because there was a story about a 9.5-ton space lab that China has up there that is floating semi out of control, that's going to crash land on Earth. And at the time, we didn't really know where it was going to go. Now, because Earth is really a lot of water and not that much land, the odds are it's going to land in the water and everything will be just fine. But there's always the possibility that things will go awry. Do we know much more about when and where this thing's going to come down?
So we know a little bit more. So the good news is amateur astronomers who have been watching this and tracking it from the ground think that it's not as out of control and tumbling as was originally expected. And that's good, meaning that its reentry is much more stable, and we're probably going to be able to get a very good prediction of at least a couple of orbits of when it will come in. So the last time we talked, Matt, I think we were talking about that there was a 2-month window. Basically, it could come in any time between March and April, and that has narrowed significantly. We now know, based on some calculations 2 days ago from the European Space Agency, which is the prime space authority that's tracking this and putting out the updates, that it's now looking like it'll be between a 12-day period between March 29th and April 9th, with April 3rd right now looking like the most logical date that it will come in based on how quickly it's been dropping in its orbit.
Now, has anybody contacted Taco Bell? Will they be putting a huge target somewhere in the ocean? Are we going to get the love that we got for what was the last famous one, the really famous one when there was a crash landing? It was a Russian ship, right? Mir?
Yes, it was Mir almost 18 years ago. And wow. Yes, so far no companies have said that they're going to put a giant floating raft
bullseye
in the middle of the ocean. And really that has to do with the fact that the reentry of Mir 18 years ago and this Chinese station, Tiangong-1's reentry, is that Mir was a very controlled reentry. We used a Russian spacecraft to fire its thrusters and slow Mir down, so we knew it was going to come in over the southern Pacific Ocean. So that's why Taco Bell put their big raft out there, and with no real way to predict even today where this is going to come in potentially at the end of the month. I don't think any company is stepping up to offer us any free goodies if something makes it to the ground.
So this is not by, and Mir, I believe, was way bigger. I mean, this is a small,
yes,
even though it's 9.5 tons, which seems ginormous, very small compared to other, space piece junk or whatever that has come crashing to Earth. Will there be a huge fireball as it reenters the system? If it's anywhere at all near land where people are, will they be able to see a huge fireball streak across the sky as it comes in?
Oh, most definitely. Especially if it's at night in the local area where it comes in, this will be very visible. Anything that reenters the atmosphere automatically creates a lot of heat and friction and a very large fireball. That's, the larger the object, the larger the fireball. And that's very normal. It's very expected. So if it is at night, people should be able to see it. And even if it's during the day, this station is probably large enough that if you know exactly where to look and if our predictions can get a fairly accurate estimate of exactly where it's going to come in, if it's during day, you might be able to see it as well. I said, that's totally normal. And if you do see it, that's actually comforting, and it should be comforting, because that means it's burning up, it's doing what we expected to do, and it will burn up. That's not to say there's a chance it won't, but that fireball, while cool, is a good sign that everything is going as expected with its reentry.
And what are the, so 9.5 tons coming in, how much of it hits ocean, hopefully, or land? What are we guessing it's down to after the burning upon reentry?
Yeah, so in all likelihood, about 99% of it will burn up in the atmosphere. What we're really concerned about, and concerned might be too much of a word, what we're, you know, potentially wanting people to understand is that the heaviest part of the spacecraft, its engines and its control module, are the pieces that are heavy enough and dense enough and surrounded by enough other material of the spacecraft that those are the pieces that could survive reentry. And the latest predictions that we have is that it's possible that up to about 100-pound piece of the engines could survive reentry and make it to the ground. Now that's incredibly heavy. Now the spacecraft is going roughly 17,500 miles per hour right now, and will be at roughly that same speed when it hits the atmosphere at the end of the month. But when any piece that survives will only be going a couple hundred miles per hour, sort of like a jet plane, a regular jet airliner landing speed once it makes it to the ground. Now that's still pretty fast for a 100-pound piece of equipment, but you know, since the space program began, there have been no confirmed cases of people actually being hit by space debris. There's someone in the Midwest who claims to have been, but NASA was never able to confirm the story.
Right.
And there's a large portion of land that's uninhabitable, right? So the chance of this actually hitting anyone or doing property damage is quite small, but there's a small percentage chance, and that's why, you know, the real story here isn't necessarily that the station is out of control. It's making sure that people are just aware of what the possibilities are once we have a better idea of where it's going to come in over.
Right. All right, let's talk real quick about asteroids, because I've talked about this before. I don't remember if you and I touched on this at all.
Yeah.
But I've had other scientists, and there's a good friend of ours with the Kepler mission who we talked to from time to time. We talked about asteroids. And I've always wondered, you know, would we ever go send Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis up and blow up while Aerosmith played in the background? And I was told at the time, very unlikely that we would do that. We'd do something, you know, we'd have a 10-year head start and we'd go paint white paint on the side of it because the radiation increase from the sun would change its trajectory, et cetera, et cetera. It'd be something simple like that. But now there was a story out today that NASA has been researching sending a ship up that would crash into it, or a nuclear explosion into an asteroid that was at risk. NASA has a list, it says in this story, of 78 dates on which this asteroid Bennu, a 1,600-foot space rock, could possibly go off course and crash into Earth, including a time when it's going to be so close it's going to be a third of the distance away from the moon, a third of the distance that the Earth is away from the moon, so actually very close. And while these are far off, supposedly they're researching using a nuclear device to detonate and knock this thing off course. Where do you think that's headed?
Yeah, so in terms of the nuclear argument, we saw those stories when they came out this week. That's honestly not the best option that we would want to deploy. It carries a lot of risk.
Oh, I think we just lost. I think we just lost Chris. It carries a lot of risk, and then there he went away. Let me put him on hold. Why don't we take a quick break, and we'll follow up next. I don't know what the risk is. I imagine launching a nuclear weapon at any point is a danger. We'll try to check in with Chris again in a minute here. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. We're speaking with Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com. Chris, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I don't know what happened there. It sounded like you went away, but I guess you were still there. And here we are.
Yeah, so, I'd like to be dramatic and give a good
That was a dramatic pause, because you left us with, That's not the best option, the nuclear option, literally, when it comes to an asteroid. What's the concern about using nuclear weapons for that?
So the concern, and you actually can see it in the movie that I'm sure we're all familiar with, Armageddon, with Bruce Willis. So with a nuclear weapon, when you detonate it, now you don't have one solid object coming at you. Now you have hundreds of objects coming at you, and you've kind of increased the possibility for damage over a widespread area if you find these asteroids so late, right, in the game. Now, what NASA was talking about and what appeared in a scientific journal this past week was specifically about smaller asteroids that we have a lot of lead time talking about, right, where we know that if we intercept them at a certain point and, you know, if we potentially go the route of nuking them, they're very small, so a lot of it wouldn't survive, and we'd have a very good idea of where those pieces would go, and that some of them wouldn't hit the Earth. You specifically mentioned the asteroid Bennu, which NASA launched a spacecraft to in 2016. That spacecraft is actually going to be arriving at the asteroid later this year. And in addition to collecting some samples from the asteroid and bringing it back to Earth, one thing that they are actually doing with that spacecraft is testing other methods of deflecting asteroids, such as landing on the surface of the asteroid and firing the engine of the spacecraft to nudge it into a slightly different orbit. And another is going into a very close proximity orbit around the asteroid and using the probe's very small gravitational field to tug that asteroid again into a slightly different orbit. And, you know, that sounds very science fiction and very fanciful, but one of the things and one of the advantages to that over a nuclear weapon scenario is that you're maintaining the asteroid and the piece of rock as an entire entity, which is much easier to track and keep track of. And you really only need to nudge it a few feet in one direction or the other in order for it to miss the Earth by miles once it actually arrives. So that's sort of the best case scenario when we can see them coming with a lot of notice. But, you know, that's not always the case. So part of what this nuclear element was that was talked about this week is starting to put together those plans of what if we don't see them coming with enough time to do that? Like, what if we only see them coming with a year's worth of notice, which, you know, in many regards would be just enough time to put something on top of a rocket and launch it at that asteroid and hope everything worked. So that's really what that story was about.
Yeah, whenever I think of them using nukes, I never thought of it as them blowing the whole thing up. I always thought it would be, you know, an explosion that alters the course of whatever is there. And I guess they are talking more about the possibility of blowing one completely up. I would think, like you said, that creates more problems possibly, unless they're small enough parts that they know they'll burn up. But otherwise, they're really just talking about altering the trajectory of these things, right?
Exactly. And, you know, part of it is, you know, you're right. Part of it is looking at, like, could a nuclear detonation, if it were small enough, you know, it doesn't have to be a huge nuclear explosion, but if it was small enough, could just the force of that explosion nudge it out of the way if we, like, exploded the warhead, you know, not on the asteroid, but near it?
Yeah.
That is certainly something they're looking at. But one of the things they would have to be super careful about and very confident about is they would really have to understand the exact composition of that asteroid in order to make sure that a blast at close range wouldn't break it up into larger parts instead of nudging it to the side. So that's what a lot of these asteroid sample missions are, is to get a good classification and understanding of what composes the asteroids of the inner solar system, not just to help us understand how the solar system formed, but in case we ever do need to do something like this and we don't have enough time to go up, sample it, you know, do a science analysis on it and, you know, see what it's made of.
I have a caller at 312-981-7200. Glenn has a question for you. Hey, Glenn, you're on with Chris Gebhardt from NASAspaceflight.com.
Good morning. How are you doing?
We're good.
What's your... I think a lot of stuff when I'm driving truck. One question is, this Chinese asteroid, right? Chinese satellite. If it were to land any part of it and someone found a piece of it, who would claim ownership? Would the person who found it? And this asteroid, if it were a clear shot that didn't hit the Earth, would it affect the tides?
Good questions. All right, hold on, Glenn. Let's see if Chris knows answers to that. All right, so if the satellite comes crashing to Earth and somehow a big piece of it stays in a chunk and it lands in my backyard, do I get to go, dude, that's my Chinese satellite. That's mine.
That would be cool, but the answer is a categorical no, you would not.
Seriously?
It belongs to the government of China. Seriously, yes.
Finders, keepers, losers, weepers, Chris. China, I'll tell you what right now. There is no way in a Trump administration he's putting up with China getting to say, that's ours, you have to give it back. He would never make me give it back. He would defend to the death my right to keep that thing. I guarantee it. Is that really our international law that if a piece of our space junk lands in China, we get to say, hey, dude, that's ours, we get it back, and they will give it to us?
Yes, actually. Wow. Yeah, so per the agreements that have been reached, that's exactly it. And there's precedent for this as well. So if a piece of this Chinese space station makes it to the ground, no matter where it makes it to the ground, if it's outside of China, the governments are obligated, if those pieces are found, to contact China, let them know, and give it back. And there is some precedent for this, actually, with a U.S. space station, Skylab, from the 1970s that re-entered over Australia.
Yeah.
And some pretty significant pieces of Skylab made it to the ground. And Australian citizens found them, notified the Australian government, and NASA was contacted and came and collected Skylab.
That was a pre-social media time, and people would not be as willing to give it up these days, that's for sure.
No, we'd probably be taking selfies with it.
Yes,
now.
We would. Now, what if it was a meteor that nobody owns? What if it wasn't some country's space junk? Then I could just keep it, right?
There's no law governing meteors. No, okay. I mean, if a small enough piece made it to your ground, made it to the ground in your backyard, no, there's no international law saying that you have to notify authorities or turn it over. Now another important point with the Chinese station, and then we'll get to the asteroid question with tides, is that if any piece of it does make it to the ground, you actually don't want to go near it, because there are potentially hazardous products on board, propellant used by the engines and the thrusters, that could have contaminated it as the tanks ruptured and burst during reentry. So if a piece of it does make it to the ground, you actually really want to call local authorities so they can send hazmat crews out to deal with it and make sure it's safe before anyone approaches it. So that's a good safety tip if any piece of it does make it to the ground. But in terms of the asteroid, so the one that we were talking about, Bennu, which is only 1,600 feet wide, it would not affect the tides of Earth, but a larger one, if it passed close enough, could exert enough gravitational tug that there'd be that scientists might notice change in the tides, but ordinary folks who are just enjoying a day at the beach or the lakefront aren't going to notice a substantial difference.
Well, that's good to know. All right. I'm sorry. I have to jump back to International Space Lab law, because now I'm fascinated by the possibility of this ending up in my backyard. So I have to give it back to the Chinese. What if it lands on my roof and completely destroys my house and my cars? Will China pay for that then?
That's a fascinating question. So the answer kind of is we don't know. You know, the what we know from in terms of property damage of vehicles making it to the ground really comes from the Columbia accident from 15 years ago, when Shuttle Columbia broke up over Texas and there was some property damage to the ground. And in that case, because it was a U.S. spacecraft and it reentered and broke up over the U.S., the U.S. federal government paid for the damages. So in terms of international, who would pay for it? that's a fascinating question that we might see play out in the courts if it transpires.
Yeah, well, hopefully nobody's got a big piece of junk in their backyard destroying anything. Hopefully it just lands over water. Question, let me ask you real quick. The current administration, there's a story that just handed me about President Trump commenting on the amazing SpaceX Falcon Heavy mission, also giving some kudos to NASA and this beautiful thing we're sending to Mars. Has the administration been a good supporter of NASA so far?
The administration has certainly taken an interest in overall space exploration. I would say there's been a lot of talk about increasing the public-private partnership, which has given us companies like SpaceX and the amazing success that they've had and that we've witnessed there. They've talked a lot about NASA's future in terms of using something called the Deep Space Gateway that NASA is planning to build near lunar orbit, in terms of using that as a staging ground for first missions to the moon, and then in a much longer term goal, taking humans to Mars. There has, however, been a proposal. It's just a proposal right now. It would still have to make it through Congress, but it came from the administration to significantly cut science funding in a lot of places. And this would include not renewing and not continuing with a lot of our climate research satellites that are currently on orbit or planned to launch. So I think with any administration, only a year in, it's really difficult to tell exactly what effect they're going to have on space exploration and spaceflight. But the Trump administration is certainly vocal about what they want to see happen for the direction of NASA and our private companies.
Well, it will be interesting to see, and I think he talks a good game. I think as far as, you know, the climate research, they're going to have to sneak that into sexier things to get that passed, because if it's stuff about climate change, things like that, as we know, the administration's not going to be real, certainly not going to be prioritizing that research, it seems. So it'll be interesting to keep following up and seeing what happens next. Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com. Visit them at NASASpaceflight.com. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone again.
Thanks, Matt. It was great to be here again.
All right, Chris. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.